Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations, where we talk about mental health, adversity, spirituality, and societal issues. I'm your host, Furkan Gandia. In this week's episode, we take a mesmerizing journey into the world of hypnotherapy with the renowned Jonathan Royal. Prepare to have your perceptions shattered as we delve into the untapped potential of the human mind. Jonathan Royal, a master hypnotist and expert in the art of suggestion, will take us on a mind-altering exploration of the subconscious, revealing the secrets of hypnotherapy that can instantly change lives. Join me as we uncover the myths and mysteries surrounding hypnosis and hypnotism, separating fact from fiction, and revealing the astonishing truths about this ancient healing art. In this episode, we'll learn the astonishing therapeutic applications of hypnosis, from overcoming phobias and traumas to enhancing confidence and achieving peak performance. Jonathan will share real-life success stories of clients who have experienced remarkable transformations, leading us to contemplate the infinite possibilities that lie within each of us. As we dive deeper into the psyche, we'll also discuss the ethical considerations and misconceptions surrounding hypnotherapy. Jonathan will enlighten us with his compassionate and responsible approach to ensure that this powerful tool is used responsibly for the greater good. Please stay tuned as Jonathan Royal guides us through a live interactive demonstration. You won't believe the profound effects that can be achieved in mere minutes. Dr. Jonathan Royal is regarded by many as one of the world's leading authorities on hypnotherapy, NLP, self-help, personal development, and self-improvement strategies and techniques. His mind skills and talents have been featured extensively on TV and radio shows and within newspapers and magazines around the world. Jonathan was born into a showbiz family while traveling with Gandhi Circus. He made his stage debut at the age of 3 as Flap the Clown. Before he reached his teenage years, he was firmly established as one of England's top up-and-coming magicians and stage illusionists. While he's better known worldwide as hypnotherapist Alex William Smith, or his stage name as Jonathan Royal. At the age of 14 in 1989, he became the youngest ever member of the Association of Professional Hypnotherapists and Psychotherapists, as founded by Dr. Brian Howard in the early 1980s. He started treating people with hypnotherapy and thus, to date, has been conducting professional paid hypnotherapy sessions for over 33 years. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you could please leave a 5-star review or a comment in the comment section at the end of the episode, I would truly appreciate it. All right, Jonathan, welcome to the Easy Conversations podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I'm really excited to learn about the work you do. And it's definitely an area I haven't covered on the podcast previously. But before we go down that road and into our conversation, I wanted to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself and let the listeners know a little bit about what it is that you do.
Thanks. Yeah. By birth, my name's Alex William Smith. And I was born on the 13th of August, 1975. I mention that purely so that if any point later mention years, you can realize I was ridiculously young when I started down the personal development and helping other people path. In fact, it was 1989, when I was still 14 years of age, that I became the youngest ever member of the Association of Professional Hypnotherapists and Psychotherapists here in England. So, and I'm 48 this August, so rough maths. Come this August, it'll be like 34 years.
Yeah.
That I've been using... Some would say hypnosis, but I prefer to say a whole bunch of different psychological positive manipulation strategies. And the reason I use the word manipulation, because a lot of people find that word manipulation a negative or a, you know, is because I feel that's a more truthful description of what we do as therapists and coaches to help people achieve what they want to achieve. It's about nudging them or manipulating them or pushing them in the right direction of things that they ultimately could have done for themselves if only they knew where to look inside themselves and what to do with what they found when they went looking. Positive manipulation to help people get their outcomes in life and also to overcome any negative shit that's holding them back, or any habits, addictions, fears, or phobias could be causing them conflict, upset, or restrictions in life. Because, you know, sometimes people have phobias, and it's not about the crippling fear of a spider might run into the room. Right. It can be, it could be something like being scared of flying. So some might say, well, just avoid flying, and then job done. And for most people, that would be the logical solution. What about the man who works in, say, sales for a big company, and the next step on the career ladder would be to accept this promotion that meant he had to travel all over the world to deliver these sales talks? Need to be able to fly. Right. So it could be that the phobia, overcoming a phobia might not just be a case of, hey, the person can then go on holiday flying instead of driving. It can be monumental, life-changing things as well. And yes, everything in between, the scales of everything, obviously.
Right, right. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I guess to kind of help debunk some of the notion around hypnosis, I guess, because that can give people a certain level of ideas, right? Whenever people hear words, certain ideas come to their mind. Are you able to walk us through what is the work that you do exactly look like?
Okay. What I'll say is first, because people do have a lot of preconceived ideas about anything connected to that word, hypnosis or hypnotism or hypnotherapy or hypnotist or any of the other HYP starting words. And despite the fact that for the past 34 years, I've worked as a clinical hypnotherapist is one title, and then the other side of what I do is I do stage hypnosis shows, the entertainment side. Despite the fact I've done that for 34 years around the world, I, somewhat unusually for most hypnotists, I'm going to sit here and tell everyone that hypnosis does not exist. There is no such thing as hypnosis. Now, let me clarify that, because what have I been doing for 34 years if there's no such thing as hypnosis? What I mean is there's no such thing as hypnosis in the way that most people perceive it to be. There is not some zombie mind brainwashed state where you go completely out of it like some automaton or robotic mind control person like you might see in horror films or science fiction books. Doesn't exist. Also, there isn't really any particular special state of mind, because there's nothing that can be achieved with hypnosis that you or any of the listeners or viewers couldn't achieve on your own without the use of hypnosis if you knew what steps to take for yourself. Right. So a hypnotist really is a little bit like a film director. And you, as the client or the patient, you might say, if it was therapeutic wise, are kind of like an actor in the film. But you may not yet have been given the full script to this section of your life, metaphorically. What the hypnotist does is kind of give you the tools, the steps, the script, call it what you will, and point you to where you should be looking and shows you what you should be doing to be able to do those things for yourself. Now, quite often that is done by helping people get into a very relaxed, meditative type state where their breathing will get more calm and relaxed, and we use breathing exercises and talk at a much slower pace to help the mind to start to settle down, and we might use background music that's very gentle and relaxing to encourage natural psychological relaxation, as well as encouraging physical relaxation at the same time, so that the people can become physically and emotionally relaxed.
Yeah.
And when you are relaxed, you automatically become more receptive to taking on suggestions, new changes, or, as, and this is my definition of hypnosis, the critical faculty. If you've got your conscious mind,
okay, yeah,
and then there's like a doorkeeper that stops negative stuff getting in, but unfortunately it also stops negative stuff that's already slipped by getting out.
Right.
And that's kind of like a nightclub doorman. It's what gets called the critical faculty or the analytical area, or some call it the executive function of the brain. And beyond that is your unconscious, your subconscious mind, the imagination.
Right.
I like to think of that as a personal network computer that's running the show. Mm. Unfortunately, before this nightclub doorman started his job, which the executive function comes into play at around teenage years, roughly around puberty. Prior to then, generally speaking, most people will have already had around 13 years of what I call mini traumas in their life. I don't mean, you know, it doesn't have to be massive bullying. It doesn't have to be child abuse. Some people are unfortunate enough to have gone through that kind of stuff, I know. All of us have mini traumas from the day we're born throughout our life. But during the formative years, from birth, Sigmund Freud, or Sigmund Freud, as some people are better, said it was till about 7 years of age. In my experience, I say it's roughly to teenage years when the nightclub doorman, the executive function of the brain, kicks in and starts working. By then, well, loads of shit's already gone in.
Yeah.
And what I mean by mini traumas is this. It's stuff that when you are 1 year old, 2 year old, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 11, 12, 13, at that time, in that moment, to you was the most important moment in your life. So as an adult, to think that a 3 year old at a birthday party playing with a balloon and that balloon then accidentally getting popped could have a negative impact on them when they grow up and become an adult in their 20s or 30s seems a bit laughable and ridiculous. And most people would probably think, no, that's actually, what are you talking about? Think about this.
Yeah.
To the 3 year old at the party in this example, their imaginations make things seem reality. Kids, you know, that's kids have imaginary friends.
Yeah.
A cardboard box can become a car, and the balloon could become a magical fairy castle in a matter of seconds.
Right.
And then an adult walks past, knocks them, and they fall over onto the balloon and it bursts and they start crying. And the adult sees that and thinks, oh, because the balloon, you know, as it burst, was dead loud, that shocked them and that's made them cry. Or it's because they've lost the balloon they were playing with. What the parent or the adult doesn't realize is that it's not just that balloon bursting. To that three-year-old, at that moment, it was no longer a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
It had become that magical fairy castle king. That's just been destroyed.
Right.
That's a massively traumatic experience. In fact, it's as traumatic to the three-year-old as it would be for us as an adult losing a loved one or a family member in a car crash.
Right.
And that gets imprinted into your personal laptop computer. And then you have other ones when you're 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It could be a teacher that just said you weren't good enough in one of the lessons. It's burnt in imprint in there because in that moment it made you feel silly and daft and worthless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the age of 7, some teacher saying that burns in there. As an adult looking back, we go, oh, that wouldn't hold you back, did it? Well, if that program ends up in that personal network computer memory bank, your unconscious, subconscious mind, and he's running in the background, and then the doorman comes on when you're about 13, roughly, puberty, when the executive function kicks in.
Yeah.
That negative can't get back out, so it's always running. So whatever conscious effort you put in to be in the best you, there's still a program in that computer going, you're not good enough. You're not worthy of this.
Right.
For as long as you allow that to continue running, you will find that you end up with things going wrong before you reach your peak potential.
Right.
The key thing I do under the guise of so-called hypnosis, and it's just a name for psychological manipulation technique, really.
Yeah.
Is to help distract that nightclub bounce, the critical faculty, the analytical area, executive function, call it what you will, but you think of it as a nightclub bounce, or I kind of use psychological manipulation techniques to bribe it, like giving it a handful of money to piss off for half an hour, okay? Go somewhere, come back in half an hour, so that there's no resistance, so I can then go into the person's unconscious, subconscious mind, metaphorically. I'm not physically doing anything, I'm talking to them. But now there's no resistance there. It's going directly to the computer. It allows me to use techniques, mainly of visualization, because the mind, the unconscious, works in abstracts and images. That's why when you dream, if you do remember your dreams, it can often be quite bizarre. Right.
Yes.
And I can then go in and metaphorically help the person to delete not the memories of those traumatic experiences. That's the kind of science fiction you see in films. You can't just delete things.
Right.
And memories themselves false anyway. Whenever you have a memory again, each and every time your mind embellishes it. Studies have proven this. So it's not what the original thing was anyway.
Right.
Distorted. But what we can do is delete, erase, and override and replace any negative thoughts, feelings, energies, or emotions connected, that were connected to those traumatic things.
Right.
So they no longer have that negative charge. Mm-hmm. So there's, or any self-blame, shame, guilt, and regret can be let go of.
Right.
So that any fear, frustration, failure, anguish, anxiety, regret, remorse, all of that can be let go of. And then we can also help the person, again, through verbally guiding them and positive psychological manipulation, to metaphorically install mental antivirus software for their personal laptop computer. So they start running positive programs that say, you know what? You are worthy. You can achieve this. You can do anything and everything. And the underlying pin of all that, as well as getting rid of the negative stuff, is a realization I had decades ago now, after going through bullying at school myself, and actually going through addictions such as cocaine, cannabis, alcohol, a whole bunch of things. I came to the realization through my training in hypnotherapy and what I observed in the people that I was helping, that all of us as human beings, in order to function at peak levels, and in order to not have negative shit going on, such as habits, addictions, fears, phobias, or self-defeating imposter syndrome, voice in the head going, you're not worthy, you're not good enough, and all that.
Yeah.
We need to feel. Feelings are purely imaginary. Feelings have no basis in reality. It's just what your mind perceives a thing. You need to feel loved, wanted, needed, appreciated, cared for, cherished, and valued. Now, they sound very similar. But if you get a thesaurus and check out loved, wanted, needed, appreciated, cared for, cherished, and valued, some of them relate to self-confidence, some to self-image, some to self-esteem, and some to self-control, aka willpower. So if there's ever been any lacking, imbalance, or negative impact, that person's level of feeling loved, wanted, needed, appreciated, cared for, cherished, or valued, which those mini traumas could have caused from birth at some point, then it would have had a knock-on effect on their self-confidence, self-image, self-esteem, and self-control.
Right.
Or one or more of them. If there's been a negative impact on them, consequently, it will negatively impact on their self-love, self-worth, self-respect, and positive selfishness. And by that, I mean, you've got to be selfish first, look after yourself to be able to help others later. If there's been any negative impact there, ultimately, it goes to the root, which is it has a negative impact on themselves, their sense of self, their self-identity, who they are, and it will leave it feeling like there's something missing, a gap.
Right.
So that, and that can then manifest itself in everyday life negatively by way of causing the person to develop a habit or an addiction or panic attacks or anxiety or overly stressed. So it's like it's making you do or feel something negative to try and get your attention and say, look, this shit needs dealing with.
Right. Right.
And ultimately, whether the individual does it for themselves through learning techniques, or they go to see a therapist who can help guide them perhaps more rapidly, the key to what I do with people is help them to feel on all levels loved, wanted, needed, appreciated, cared for, cherished, and valued. So it balances out what I call the psychological pillars and gives them stability, emotional, psychological stability, so that that in turn will impact and repair the self-confidence, self-image, self-esteem, and self-control, which in turn repairs their self-love, self-worth, self-respect, and positive selfishness, which in turn kind of heals the self-identity and makes them feel whole again. Right. It's like the missing piece of the jigsaw being pushed in.
Mm-hmm.
And when that positive roller coaster of things has been put into place, which is done by getting past that nightclub bells metaphor, critical faculty, analytical area, reprogramming personal laptop computer, then the person can find that they suddenly discover they've been able to let go of all that self-blame, shame, guilt, regret, all the negative shit, any negative charges connected that were frozen in time to those past traumas. And it allows them to be the adult they always could and should have been if they'd not had those frozen in time moments holding them back. If they'd not had that kind of bug in the software of the mind running in the background, so that now their little internal voice will be saying, you are worthy, you can do this, go for it, you're a winner, rather than running like the slow virus-infected computer going, you can try, but you're not good enough.
Right.
That's kind of a word picture of what I do, the underlying reason why things work. And on top of that, don't get me wrong, there's elements of ritualistic processes I go through with people. And the main reason those work is because it, again, helps distract the conscious mind and the critical faculty to then get abstract ideas and imagery to the unconscious mind that works on pictures, to instill pictures of themselves, for example, as the person they want to be, the best possible version of them in the future, so that then can become a self-fulfilling prophecy for them as well. Mm-hmm. You get more of what you focus on in life. If you're always thinking negative shit, you're going to get negative outcomes. Mm-hmm. If you've got positive stuff running, you're more likely to think positively. If you're thinking more positively, you're more likely to get positive results.
And
it's a circular thing.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you for explaining all that and that metaphor. I really appreciate it. And I think, you know, to kind of summarize it in a way, like, we all have those incidents from childhood, whether you could have something more traumatic than others. It's all very subjective and relative to the individual. And we obviously create that internal narrative that some of us can access, but it really, for a lot of us, it sits in the unconscious. And that's some of the work that you alluded to. Freud did, even Carl Jung talked about. And you can access it through your dreams. You can access it through just conscious awareness of how it's presenting itself in your everyday life, through your relationships, through your choices in life. As you alluded to, that could show up as addictions, or it could be that same pattern you're repeating in your romantic relationships. So not a lot of us become aware of it, but a lot of us can get access to that information through therapy. And some of the work I've done is EMDR is another form of therapy that I've done, which allows you to basically reprocess that information and have a different perspective on it. But what you're saying is hypnosis is just another tool individuals can use to access that information and just reprogram how they perceived it.
Essentially, yeah, the truth of the matter is, whether you call it hypnosis, eye movement desensitization, reprogramming, EMDR, TFT, EFT, which are different tapping, Meridian therapy techniques, it doesn't really matter what what it's called or what right. the important seeming ritualistic process seems to be, or what people say is why it works. The truth is, if we get down to cold hard brass tacks, and this was some therapists who hear this, the fact is it's not the tapping on meridian points. That scientifically is proven that's bullshit. It is not the wiggling of the fingers of the eyes. There's actually more evidence that that's bollocks than there is that makes the processing. It's not the fact that the hypnotist has hypnotized you.
Right.
What it is, all of those things offer some form of focus, positive focus, and therefore also an inbuilt distraction.
Mm-hmm.
In one way or another, distracts the critical faculty, the analytical area, executive function, nightclub, dorm, call it what you will. That distraction right. might be concentrating on where you're tapping. Distraction mm-hmm. might be wiggling your fingers or blinking at a certain time. That distraction might be breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth and clenching the muscles in your toes and then just letting them go limp, loose, relax, and working through the muscles. It can be a whole bunch of important seeming ritualistic processes, given different names for marketing purposes. But the ultimate thing is, as long as the therapist has got positive intent to help the individual in front of them.
Right.
And as long as the individual truly, genuinely desires change in that moment.
Right.
Then whatever the process is can serve to get the nightclub dormant to disappear for a bit, so that whatever process is used doesn't really matter. The key is positive intent and helping empower the individual to do for themselves and believe in themselves. Believe is a key word.
Right.
Because the moment they believe that they've made some kind of change within themselves, the moment they truly believe that, then arguably they actually have done. He's like Roger Bannister with the 4-minute mile. Nobody believed it was possible to run a mile in 4 minutes.
Right.
And there was loads of other people at the exact same skill level of training and ability as Roger Bannister. And one day he did the 4-minute mile, just under 4 minutes. And these people on the same physical level, training level as him, saw him do that. And suddenly in that moment, that second of seeing it, mm-hmm. as quickly as that, their belief changed from "it's not possible" to "it is possible." And over right. the next week, a couple more of them did it. Over the next month, tons of them that were at the same physical level as Roger Bannister did it. The only difference between Roger Bannister and those others that did it after him is he was the first to truly believe it was possible.
Right.
That's how quickly. But the moment other people saw the evidence that it was possible, in that split second, they suddenly believed it was possible. The only right. thing that had been stopping them up to that point, because they were at the same physical level and same training level as Roger Bannister, was just a belief, a thought. Mm. And the change of that one thought in a split second, because it's in the evidence that Roger Bannister had done it, in that second of realization, they too became capable right. of doing it.
Yeah. And that's the power of the human mind, right? But the biggest thing you touched on there was the positive intent of the individual doing the hypnotherapy or the therapist, because I think that preconceived notion around, or negative preconceived notion around hypnotherapy, is also the aspect of manipulation, right? Is this person going to hypnotize me and make me do something out of my will? But to your yeah. point, it really comes back to that positive intent of the individual doing it.
Can people apparently hypnotize you or use psychological manipulation techniques yeah. to make people do things against their will and values? Yes, they can. And any hypnotist or therapist who tells you otherwise is either incompetent or doesn't know what they're talking about, or is too scared to admit the truth to their clients, thinking it might scare them off.
Mm-hmm.
The key is, if you're a potential client for a therapist, search for social proof. Find a therapist that's got video testimonials from past clients who are saying, you know, my life was like this, it's now like this, improve. If they've got a whole bunch of social proof, even better if you get a personal referral from somebody you know, then you can feel safe. You can use due care and diligence. There's good people and bad in every industry.
Right.
the techniques, it's like a hammer. You know, a hammer can put nails in the wall and pull them out. It could also hit somebody on the head and kill them. It's about right. The intent of the person using it. So, yeah, these techniques could be used negatively, and they are used nefariously by governments to mind control and manipulate people, by advertisers to nudge people into buying things they didn't particularly want. That's going on around you in every aspect of your life.
Right.
But those same underlying principles used with positive intent to positively manipulate. So, yeah, I'm saying we are manipulating people, but with positive intent.
Right.
And without wanting to sound too winky, wanky, arty, farty, new age, tree hug style, I would argue that intent is a kind of energy. People can sense it.
Right.
And if they're feeling that positive intent, you could argue energy, that in itself, well, energy healers would definitely say that that energy is healing.
Right.
That's what they do. But scientifically, studies have shown that that positive intent, which is scientifically called the Pygmalion effect, also known as the Rosenthal effect, people want to check it out, is that if you as the therapist project your positive intent that you believe the process you're going to work through with the client is going to help them and change their life and truly believe it, then that will get transmitted even non-verbally to the client in front of you. And they will pick up on it. And when they pick up on it and start to believe that this is going to work for them, the Galatea effect, as it's known in psychology, kicks in, which is the proven fact that people who believe that a process is going to work for them are more likely to find that it will work for them. So when the Pygmalion Rosenthal triggers off the Galatea, and then combined with that, we go through some sort of important seeming ritualistic process, which therefore distracts the critical faculty, reduces resistance, but also triggers off the placebo effect, which is not a negative thing. It's the most wonderful thing on the planet because it can help people change their lives. And we add into that a level of kind of accountability and observation, which we don't just do the session and say goodbye to them. We do a follow-up and make sure that the client's doing okay. And the person knows you're going to be in contact to make sure they're okay. So they don't want to let themselves or you down, which brings in the Hawthorne effect. All of these many things, as well as perhaps you might give them, you know, some healers would give them a lucky crystal. A hypnotherapist might give them an audio relaxation track to listen to every day for the next 28 days. A tap-in therapist may give them a little process of where to tap. That can kick in what's known as the totem effect because they've got some kind of lucky charmish type thing.
Right.
All of these things, none of them on their own, all of them together get glued together by that positive intent to make something bigger than the whole of the past, which is ultimately to empower the individual to let go of the negative shit of the past, which is why I call my book Shit Gnosis, and to get over the shit and move forward and be the best possible man, which they theoretically could have always done for themselves. It's just that they may not have believed it was possible to do it for themselves.
Right, right.
If we think back to Roger Bannister, beliefs can be the greatest motivator to make you to achieve things, but can also be the biggest block as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So sometimes they need the external source of this positive energy and intent from a therapist, authority figure, to allow them permission to change and an excuse to change and an environment to let go of all that baggage and shit from the past in a way where they don't have to feel bad about not having done it soon.
Right. For sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for building on that. And one of the things I wanted to understand, because you said, you know, a lot of the work you started was at the age of 14. And obviously, you know, at that point, you probably weren't trained as a therapist, probably became trained more as a therapist later on in life. What was it at the age of 14 that you found in yourself that you were able to offer to other people?
Well, just to clarify, at the age of 14, I became the youngest ever member of the Association of Professional Hypnotherapists and Psychotherapists here in England. I was a fully trained clinical hypnotherapist, the youngest person to ever pass the exam. Yeah, I've done more training courses over the decades than probably anyone out there, just because I wanted to see if there was anything else to learn. And the truth of the matter is that the original training course I did beat every other hypnotherapy training course I've ever done since from anyone, anywhere in the world. And I've done hundreds of them. I've done tapping courses, EMDR, you name it, I've done it. And the original course I did back then, I was so impressed by it, was I, and have been continually over the decades with the results I've been able to get in helping people overcome habits, addictions, fears, phobias, panic attacks, achieve performance, you name it, whatever you can think of can help them with it. If it's got a psychological element, then they can be helped with it.
Right.
And
I guess
all comes back to that course. And so therefore, when Dr. Brian Howard, who was my original teacher, was retiring, I did a Victor Kayan, you know, the shaver guy who was so impressed with the blade. He bought the electric shaver company, and I bought out the APHP training course, which I now offer through my training school.
Right. I guess what I wanted to understand was there a skill that you had at that early age that others probably don't have as far as hypnotherapy go?
Oh, okay. No. So, but it's not a skill that, it's not sort of a case of having something you're born with. You can learn the skill. It just happens that I was bizarrely unique at the age of 14 in that I'd had an upbringing where I was born on the circus. So I was born on a traveling circus. And at the age of three, I became Flap the Clown, Britain's youngest paid circus clown. And I was performing from the age of three and a bit, doing two shows a day, 6 days a week in the circus. By the time I was about eight or nine, I'd also started adding conjuring and magic to my skill repertoire and started doing magic shows. By the time I was 12, I was doing kind of mind reading, psychic style shows as well. So the performance skills I had gave me performance ability, because I, you know, I look at a therapy session as being a bit like a theatrical performance.
Right.
The more I can the part of what the client's perception of a therapist, hypnotist, whatever is in their mind, the more what I deliver ties in with what they believe and expect it to be, the more it's going to enhance their belief systems, the idea that this is going to work for them. So I already have that kind of theatrical performance background and skill set when I came to the table. However, for those people who haven't, if they were thinking of becoming a hypnotherapist, check out ultimatehypnosiscourse.com. As I say, Brian Howard in his training did cover such things. That's one of the key things he covered that other courses don't tend to the hypnotherapy world, and that is what I would call performance skills, the delivery of it, thinking of your consulting room, whether that's in a building or it's over Zoom sometimes these days, we have that technology. You know, if I was doing a therapy session, I wouldn't be using this back. I'm here at home. I've not gone into the office. We're recording this. If I was doing a therapy session, I'd be in the office, and in the background, what you would see would be diplomas, certifications, of courses I'd done. You'd see a bookshelf that's got all these big psychology books on it. That you know, you'd see them there, and you'd go, "Oh, he's read all them. He must know what he's talking about." You would see things that were giving non-verbal suggestions to you that. Right. I know what I'm doing, that this is going to work for you, that you're in safe hands. Every element of what I say and do with clients, whether that's in person or, I know it sounds bizarre, but through the pages of a book like this, albeit that it's not just words on a printed page. We live in a world where we can do things we didn't used to be able to do. So thanks to these things, QR codes, people can just scan them with their device and it takes them to online live kind of virtual interactive treatment sessions and training sessions where the techniques I teach them in the pages of the book Right. I demonstrate and talk them through, so it makes it easier for them to learn them, use them, and benefit from them. Because there's a world of difference between reading words on a page and trying to work out, am I tapping the right place or am I moving my eyes right? Because there are techniques like that in here. It's a damn sight easier to watch a video and have somebody say to you, okay, now lift up your right arm, take that finger, do this, and talk you through it. Mm-hmm. Because that also gives you kind of that feeling that somebody's there, they've got your back, they're there supporting you. Right. And sometimes that's all somebody needs, a bit of moral support. A metaphorical tap on the back is going to be okay. You are worthwhile. Just to nudge them positively enough in the direction, believing in themselves enough to be able to do things for themselves they were always capable of. They just didn't believe it until that point.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, absolutely. And you also touched on the whole idea of nonverbal cues. And we talked about how ad agencies or marketers, they're always doing these things to manipulate us in a way to buy into the product or buy into an opinion or a view. What are your thoughts on that? Like, because those are typically nonverbal often or verbal cues that were given through ads. What are your thoughts around that? And what can people do to be more aware of those things?
Well, one real simple thing they could do is go to my YouTube channel, which is Celebrity Hypnotist. Click on where it says playlists. And look for the playlist called Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. Mm-hmm. And in there, they will find my web series, as well as the 1 hour, 50 minute long documentary that I made in 2019 and was released on David Icke's iconic television channel. But we've also released it now on YouTube for free, where I examine all areas of life, from politics, education system, the workplace, marketing, the sports arena, every area of life. And I break down and give examples of how the powers that be manipulate and control us, both verbally and not verbally. But one thing that's always involved, whether it's on a low level or a massive level, is trauma or pain.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are more motivated by pain than they are by pleasure. You'd think that people would do things to seek out pleasure.
Right.
But when you get down to the nitty-gritty, actually people are more likely to do things to avoid pain than they are to achieve pleasure. Because the way they're wired up, they feel as though that by avoiding the pain, that itself is a pleasurable thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas that leaves them short. If they focus more on achieving pleasure than focusing on avoiding pain, because you get more of what you focus on in life. So if you're trying to avoid pain, invariably what you'll end up with is more pain and negativity in your life.
Right.
And people that do advertising or run political campaigns and want people to think one way or another know this. And in fact, they've invested millions right. of dollars into it. Going as far back as just after the war, the first war, the MK Ultra was set up to study trauma-based mind control by the CIA in America, but that was run in conjunction with the Tavistock Hospital here in London, England, which has since morphed into the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, which is tied in with, and people can check these things on Google, these are not conspiracy theories, they've got websites, they proudly boast about what they do. Right. They're linked in with the Behavioral Insights team, which is based at Westminster near the Houses of Parliament in England, where the government is. The Behavioral Insights team is affectionately, I use that term loosely, dubbed in the media as the nudge unit, because their job is to nudge people's thought patterns one way or the other politically. Right. And often that's done through trauma or negativity or pain, because people will do more to avoid pain than they will to seek out pleasure. So yeah, my documentary breaks that down, gives examples, shows how it happens and the ways to avoid it. The key way is stop picking up newspapers, stop putting on the television news. There's an old saying in the media, if it bleeds, it leads. What that means amongst journalists is that the more horrific or traumatic the story is, the bigger prominence it gets on the headlines or the front page, because right. that's what sells papers and kicks up emotional reactions in people. And the motives of the powers that be is to keep the majority of the mass populace in an easily manipulated state. Best way to do that is have them in some mild state of constant fear. Mm. And they do that using false evidence against reality or false evidence appearing real, so that people end up disagreeing with each other. The whole point of politics, okay? If there was anything ever achieved by voting, they wouldn't allow us a vote.
Right.
They give us a vote, so we have the illusion of choice and an illusion of an involvement. And so there's a created enemy, and they purposely cause division and people to argue against each other about different political beliefs or different religious beliefs, different yep. beliefs, full stop. Because they want that, because then there will be the them and us mentality where people argue and disagree, and that causes confusion and disorientation in right. the mass populace. And while people are in that state of confusion and disorientation, what the effing hell's going on in the world through the negativity, but out through the media,
right?
Then they're never going to unite together, which means they can be easily nudged and manipulated. Whereas everyone ignored the news, sought out their own news when they wanted to from multiple different sources. And the reason for that being is, you know, Rupert Murdoch, for example, he owns numerous media publications, but he owns them to have different political viewpoints.
Right.
He has a market base for one of his publications where they would say a certain thing had occurred. But on the same day, another one of his publications would be telling the same story, but in a different manner, because the people who buy that publication are from a different political background. Mm-hmm. Why is this? Is either genuine news of what's happening or there isn't? It shouldn't be that over here it's told one way and over here it's told another. If it's truthful news, if telling the truth about what was going on was the true motive, it would be consistent. But right. it isn't. It's biased to cause division and confusion and confusion, disorientation, and to instill fear in people to right. distract from what yeah. would be the ideal for the world, everyone uniting together.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you could see that even with the algorithms, that you could easily go down a rabbit hole if with a certain thought process, and that will only reinforce the way you're thinking because you're constantly fed the information that aligns with your beliefs or views. So it is a pretty slippery slope when you think about it.
And in that regard, you know, the British government have what is deemed, and this is open knowledge, people can go and search and check, this is true, a thing that was considered to be a military-grade psychological weapon that you had to get permission to use. And this technology was put together by a company called Cambridge Analytica. And basically, it was used to influence the Brexit vote in England, to influence the presidential campaigns in America and other political things around the world have been. And, you know, recently Elon Musk on Twitter, since he's taken over Twitter, has started publishing on his own Twitter profile, the Twitter files, as he's calling them, providing further proof that social media algorithms and stuff were most definitely manipulated to emotionally nudge, control people into different thoughts and feelings,
right.
emotions and reactions. So it's not conspiracy theory, you know. The guy who's taken over Twitter has looked and gone, yeah, it was going on. Here's the evidence. You know, right. he's gone clean about it.
Yeah.
And that's, if that's the stuff we know about, what is going on that we don't consciously know about?
Right.
That's the
right.
bigger question.
Yeah. 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 And I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, I don't, whether people want to call it conspiracy or not, or obviously there is a polarity in thinking right now. I think you just have to focus on what's in your control and obviously do your best to be consciously aware of some of the messaging that you're probably in taking and how that may be affecting you. But you know, and you'd also mentioned that, you know, you could probably do a demonstration of hypnosis on here. Is that something you're willing to do?
Yeah, but I mean, because I've already explained that hypnosis isn't really anything particularly freaky.
Right.
It's just use of words and words to conjure up images in somebody's mind. So, you know, if you as listeners would be able to do this as well, but if you are listening and you want an even better sensory experience, seek out the source of the video version of this on YouTube or whatever social media platforms, because then you can have a visual experience as well. The more senses you use, the more it makes it a multi-sensory experience. Well, yeah, let's do a little experiment for those that choose they want to take part. Obviously, do not do this if you are driving. Do not do this if you are operating machinery or if you're making tea in the kitchen and are using sharp knives. Please apply common sense, okay? As long as you're in a safe environment where it would be appropriate to ultimately end up with your eyes closed in a few moments' time for the next 2 or 3 minutes, then participate. Otherwise, please do not until you are in such a safe environment. So with that said, the little experiment we'll do is to prove to you how powerful your mind is about you. I'm just going to say words. They mean nothing without you adding and attaching meaning and value to. So we're going to do a thing where ultimately, if you follow this through, you're going to be able to have that experience that in a few moments from now, it's going to be almost as if your eyelids are going to end up locked, glued, welded, cemented, bolted together. And you'll be unable to open them until I clap my hands like this. But the very moment, the very second, the very instant I clap my hands like that, as soon as you're ready, you'll then be able to open your eyes and you'll be your normal self in every way. And indeed, I'll also add to that, if for any reason your internet connection was to suddenly break down when your eyes were locked, you wouldn't have to panic or anything like that. That knowledge that your internet connection has suddenly gone would allow your unconscious mind, your imagination, to let go of that idea of your eyes being locked, and you'd find you'd be able to open them and remain safe and normal in every manner as and when you needed to. But until then, if you use your powers of intelligence, imagination and concentration effectively, as I'm sure you can and will do, then what I'd like you to do, each and every one of you, is take a nice deep breath in through your nose and then out through your mouth. In through your nose and then out through your mouth. And you should continue breathing deeply and regularly. It just allows all that stale air to get out of your body and fresh oxygen to get into your bloodstream to reoxygenate the blood. And that in itself, over the next minute or two, will help you to feel a sense of calmness, a sense of upliftment, a sense of relaxation. And what's going to happen here is I'd ask you now to just close your eyes. So you consciously closing your eyes, you close your eyes down. And then imagine in a way that feels right for you. And when I say imagine things, it doesn't mean you're going to see them in glorious technicolor. Some people do. Some people don't see anything at all. Some people have to kind of speak to themselves with that internal voice and talk themselves through the process. Doesn't matter. Whatever feels right for you is right for you. So I'd like you to imagine that it's almost as if in your mind's eye, you continue breathing deeply and regularly, you start to realize that with every breath that you take, every noise that you hear, every word that I say, and every thought that you think, it merely serves as a sign and a signal for your eyelids to become heavier and heavier with every second that passes by. It's almost as if all the little muscle groups of your eyelids are like little knots, and we're going to imagine in your mind's eye untying all those little knots. And if you imagine those little knots untying, they become like little separate pieces of rope, and they immediately become so limp, so loose, so relaxed, so heavy, and so tight. And it feels so much better to allow that to happen. As you imagine now in your mind's eye, as those knots rapidly untie and those ropes become separate, you can imagine now in a way that feels right for you, it's almost as if you can imagine that inside your mind, you can imagine there is a control room in your mind that is the control room for your body. You may imagine this, you might see a door, or you might just speak it to yourself. But in whatever way it feels right to you, just imagine it's almost as if there's a door and it says the control room to your mind. And I'd like you to imagine going up to that door, opening the door and walking in. And when you do, imagine it's almost as if you can see a whole bunch of panels, dials, and knobs and buttons and switches and control panels of all manners and descriptions. And as you look around that room, it's almost as if you instinctively know where to go to find the switch or the button or the dial or the lever, whatever it is for you, that is the one that controls all the power and all the energy to the little muscle groups around your eyelids. Take a few moments to find that switch, dial, that button or that lever, whatever it is for you. And on the count of three, I'm going to go 1, 2, 3. And on the count of three, I'd like you to imagine turning off that switch or pressing the button or sliding the dial down or whatever it is you need to do so that you know in your mind's eye, using your powers of intelligence, imagination and concentration effectively, you know that you've turned off all that energy to those little muscles around your eyelids. So one, focus on that button, lever, dial, switch, or whatever it is for you, the correct control. Two, get ready to switch it off or press it or slide it down, whatever it is you need to do to turn off all that energy to those little muscle groups. And on three, in a way that feels right for you, just imagine turning off all the energy to those little muscle groups around your eyelids. And immediately feels like a sense of relaxation and letting go, feeling good inside. And when you know, in every nerve, fiber, tissue, and muscle of your body, when you just know that you've done that correctly, when you know you've turned off the right switch or slid the right lever or turned the right dial, whatever is right for you, and when you know that you've turned off all the energy to those little muscle groups around your eyelids, just prove to yourself you've done it correctly and just try and open your eyes. But you'll notice when you do that you just don't have the energy or the ability to do that because you've turned off that energy correctly. That's fantastic. And the more you try, the more they lock, glued, weld and cement and bolt together, proving to you how wonderfully you've been able to take control of your mind. But also remembering that the very moment I clap my hands in a moment, that switch will go back on or that dial will go back up and you'll have the energy to be able to open your eyes. And when you do, you'll notice a positive side effect. You'll feel better than you did before we started this exercise. It'll be almost as low, the factory reset button's been pressed and the batteries have been replaced, giving you a new sense of calm and confidence inside. On the count of three, get ready for me to clap my hands and all that to occur. One, two, three. Open your eyes just as rapidly and safely as feels good for you. And that's brilliant, everyone. And just, if there's anyone else not opened your eyes yet, do it now. Open your eyes. That's fantastic. You can do. Brilliant. Everyone's back with us.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jonathan, for that experiment. I appreciate it. And thank you for coming on here. I really valued everything you shared and appreciate everything you were able to talk us through.
Thank you very much for having me on. And people, everything I do, and then this is the only plug I've got. I don't want you to contact me and become a therapy client. I don't. You know why? Because I charge a bare minimum of $500 a session. And there's no reason for you to be spending money like that. All you need to do is buy a copy of this for $17 off Amazon. And because of the QR codes inside that are virtual treatment session, you will never need to see me for real in person. And therefore, you will never need to spend hundreds of dollars. The only thing you need to do other than investing $17 for shit gnosis, helping you get over the shit in your life and get your shit together, is to actually take action on what's inside it. But if you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting what you've always got. You've actually got to put a bit of effort in, put some skin in the game, so to speak. It's not a magic wand. Things don't just happen by themselves. You've actually got to apply the knowledge that's shared in the book.
Yeah, well, I'll put that in the show notes. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming on again. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you for checking this episode out with Jonathan Royal. As always, please leave a review or a comment in the comment section. I always love hearing from you. Or subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so. That's the best way to support the podcast. Thank you, and until next week.